Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Jaya Jaya Prabhupada, 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 Jaya Prabhupada, Jaya Jaya Prabhupada, 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 Jaya Prabhupada. Sankatan Yajna Ki Jai, Ananta Koti Vaishnava Vrinda Ki Jai. All glories to the Assembled Devotees. All glories to the Assembled Devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Sri Gauranga. We are describing the ways of the saintly persons, of the sadhus. And on the first day, we have been discussing different definitions. And in one of these definitions, we find a description of how a sadhu can either be someone who turns away from the world and is very renounced, or someone who lives right in the middle of the world. Like I have here a little something I took from the conversations of Srila Prabhupada. Indian men. No, but he says that legions of sadhus, such white men, persons from West, become sadhus, then who will do this job of earning a living? Prabhupada, why is he crying? If he's hungry, let him come here. We shall provide him. Why is crying for that? What business he has got to cry? What will they do? What they will they do that they know? Why is he crying? What is his business for crying for this future? If he's hungry, let him come and we shall provide him. That is a childish conception. If everyone becomes sadhu, then what will be the nature of society? That is, That never becomes. To become sadhu and to become a Vaishnava is not so easy thing. These idle questions, why they publish, I do not know. This is idle question. It never becomes. Lord Krishna personally says that you simply surrender unto me. How many have surrendered till now? Lord Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that you give up everything and surrender unto me. So how many have done that? So this is a rascal question. If everyone surrenders, then what will happen to the world? But that will never happen. It is very difficult to surrender. That he does not know. Hindi. It is not expected that everyone become sadhu. To become sadhu is not so easy thing. Especially this nature of sadhu. Pure. How many are there? We have given the prescription that give up this, give up this. How many have given up this? So that is not possible. But still, these nonsense questions are raised. Hansadutta, should I go on? Prabhupada, Hansadutta, as in India, so in the West. Prabhupada, this class of question is answered. No, criticized. There was a big market, because in the village there is hut every weekly. So in the village, one old woman, she saw, oh, how shall I provide all these men at night? Where will they sleep? So many guests has come. What can I do? She began to cry. So her son said, mother, you don't bother. They will go away. No, no, no. How can I provide? So in the evening, he brought the mother. Now see. So when she saw that nobody is there, theoretically, she began to cry. Where shall I provide all so many guests? And this class of question is like that. Simply on theoretical, they're asking. Hansadutta, it goes on. Yes. Hansadutta, as in India, so in the West, the sadhus will have to live on alms given by others and will have to forgo many of. Prabhupada, he does not know what is sadhu. He's not sadhu, he's grihastha. I have got many professors, engineers, so they're Krishna bhaktas. Are they not sadhus? The rascal does not know. That sadhu means beggar, he knows. Arjuna became a sadhu. He was a beggar, so he does not know what is sadhu. Sadhu's description is given. Bhajate mam, ananya. So, in this discussion, Srila Prabhupada points out that sadhu doesn't just mean someone who goes into the forest, someone who renounces the world. It doesn't really matter so much. Ashram is just a sake of convenience. Right? One may find that one ashram is more convenient than another, but ultimately there is no perfect ashram. Every ashram has many problems. It's really what we do with the ashram. The grihastha ashram is sometimes described as the safe ashram, and of course within that ashram there are many there are more possibilities to mix with the material energy, and that can be a disadvantage, but it can also be an advantage. Right? In the renounced ashrams, there is not so much opportunity to deal with the material energy, and then it can become too much for the mind. Right? Then one may not be able to maintain, and one may fall down. Whereas when we are in an ashram where we are interacting more with the material energy, then it may be possible to do that in a regulated way. So it doesn't really matter very much. We make such a big thing about this question, you know, like, shall I get married, shall I not, etc., count the buttons, but ultimately it's really, what do we do with our ashram? Ashram is only a secondary thing. It's not the main thing in our spiritual life. The main thing is that we somehow or other have to be pure, and that is difficult in all circumstances, in all ashrams. And purity is more than just following four regulative principles. One may say, yes, okay, that is pure, but then the next stage of purity is that one must actually, even within his thoughts, be pure, not only in actions, and that is much more difficult. So, in this way, we can choose an ashram, but then we have to understand and take it that also the grihastha ashram is an ashram. So wherever we live, that we live really in an ashram. And that is not always going on these days, at least not in my perception. A lot of people are just living. Right? They just move in a house somewhere and, you know, start living and try to add some Krishna consciousness to it as good as they can. But I think we should really take it. This is an ashram. And that is where the topic that we discussed earlier about tradition is coming back in, because in tradition there is this concept of, really an ashram. Right? That, so from the day we join, something has changed. From that day on, we always live in an ashram, a place for cultivating spiritual life. And whether you move into the ashram of the temple or whether you set up your own ashram, should be an ashram. So one's house should be an ashram. And that means that one should, within that house, have many things that remind us of Krishna. Right? That is the main thing, and that everyone has to do. You see that also in the Brahmachari ashram. Brahmachari ashram is the ashram for being the humble servant of the spiritual master. And Brahmachari doesn't have much facility, is supposed to have very little possessions. But if the Brahmachari is not cultivating a nice spiritual atmosphere, then he cannot maintain his Brahmacharya after some time. He also needs that spiritual atmosphere to sustain that ashram. So that is very much part of the ashram. And, well, so that's my first point, I guess, on about Grihastha life.
Huh?
You want me to elaborate on the spiritual atmosphere of a Brahmachari, huh? Life. Okay. I think in all ashrams, right, one needs to drive out the lower modes of material nature. Right? So that means the atmosphere has to be very serene, clean, and there has to be something to remind us of Krishna. It helps, nice pictures of Krishna, a little altar, something devotional actually has value. It's not a luxury, it's actually something that sustains us. To offer a little incense on your little altar, just in the room, it's nice. It actually sanctifies the entire room. So such kind of activities are not at all luxury. Now, our process of devotional service is outlined by Rupa Goswami. And he's given 64 items of devotional service. We find the same described by Sanatan, or in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, in the discussion between Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Sanatan Goswami. And it is said that these are the principles for all time, place, and circumstances. So that's, I found, a very significant statement, because there you go, these 64 items, all time, place, and circumstances, that is spiritual life, these 64 items of devotional service, okay? According to Chaitanya Charitamrita. And then, out of those, the five principal limbs are really the most important. That is, hearing Srimad Bhagavatam, being in the association of devotees, worshipping the deities, residing in Vrindavan or in the Holy Dham, in Mathura Dham, Mayapur Dham, of course, and chanting the holy name of the Lord as the most important. It is a fact that we have to have especially these five in our life, and we should surround ourselves with these five activities wherever we go. In the temple, maybe it's not required to have your own temple in your room, you know, like Prabhupada didn't encourage that. But if you live away from the temple, then it makes a lot of sense to have some deity worship going. And if we don't have deity worship directly, then at least some pictures, something, right, to remind us. It's also, it's not a luxury to hang some pictures of the deities in the Sankirtan van. It's not at all it is not a luxury to actually offer whatever we eat nicely. You know, if we would actually, instead of, you know, saying some quick prayers over whatever it is to turn it into prasadam, right? It's nicer if we have a little altar and actually put it there. Because these five principal limbs are, it says, by them we'll develop love of God very quickly. So the Brahmachari ashram that must be there, and every ashram that must be there. Yeah? There's not much difference, actually, on what you're supposed to do. I mean, there's a few. In the Grihastha Ashram, there are a few other considerations. You know, there's a consideration of that the opposite sexes are mixing, so one must be careful with that. Right? One must be a little more careful about illicit sex, because the opportunity is right there, whereas in the other ashrams it's a little more remote. But where there's a will, there's a way, and you know, where there is no nothing to spiritually support us, then we become weak, and then we will deviate from the four regulative principles. That is another important theme of what I'm discussing day after day, more or less, is that we really can't maintain the regulative principles and the principles of a certain ashram just on the strength of determination. Right? No matter how determined one is, it is not possible, right, to maintain. One can be the most determined person in the world, very stubborn, but it won't work. Sooner or later, it will be hollowed out. Right? Therefore, I brought out the point yesterday that we need happiness, we need taste in our spiritual life, we need to actually relish devotional service. Otherwise, with time, we become tired and our determination becomes less and less and our strength becomes less. And ultimately, the determination to follow the regulative principles will become less. And that is what will happen. So we need that kind of spiritual culture, right, which is centered around these five principal activities. Like I say many times in classes, that we should think that we live in Vrindavan and that we are just visiting whatever part of the world we are, right? Although we may be there, you know, 11 months and 29 days, doesn't matter. Even if you're 1 day a year in Vrindavan, that's still that. Then you're home, right? And that's it, you know. Maybe we're home once in every 3 years, doesn't matter, right? But that's where home is. And if we develop this mood, then we have pictures, you know, we always think of, like, yes, the Dham, you know, that's home, that's home. And of course, you have to develop a relationship with the Holy Dham, right? You cannot just come to the Holy Dham and artificially say, this is home. We have to understand how it's home and why it's home. It's obviously, it's very simple why it's home. The Dham is home because it's Krishna's home. Right? He lives here. Right? So that's pretty obvious then, that wherever there's Krishna, that's where we want to go. So in that way, the Dham is our natural home because it is the home of Krishna and of worship of Krishna. So then we have to just learn to fit into that, which in the beginning may be a little difficult, maybe austere. We may not be able to appreciate it. We may get the malaria and the mosquitoes and everything else, and then it may not be possible to appreciate things. So it may take some time to really develop a relationship. But it is important to develop this relationship with the Holy Dham. It is not a luxury. It's not something that's so expensive. Do we have to go all the way to India? Not at all. It's like an essential, one of the five essential elements of our spiritual life. And Prabhupada did say that living in the temple is like, that is the representative of the Dham. The temple is a Vaikuntha atmosphere and so forth. But still, it's not the same as actually spending time in the Holy Dham. Because we may even have like a new Vrindavan, a new Mayapur, a new Vrajamandal, or so many new places, right? And that the devotees of new Vrindavan always used to ask Prabhupada if it was the same, right? If new Vrindavan was the same as the former Vrindavan. And sometimes Prabhupada said, yes, right? It is the same because by the mercy of Lord Chaitanya, certainly. Everything will be manifest here, the worship is there. But still, we are seeing that in Vrindavan Dham here in India, that this is that particular place where the Lord appears on the planet, which is eternal. Okay? This is His eternal abode. It is sometimes covered, sometimes not, but it is always there. And in these holy dhams, Krishna is especially manifesting Himself. Right? That we are seeing. That somehow or other, Krishna is revealing Himself in a very special way. So, in every ashram, we depend on that. Right? It doesn't matter. Like, I saw some just a few days ago, one grihastha was telling me, like, today we're he said yesterday I walked to the yoga pit, because he was getting up very slowly from his seat, you know, like really. I said, wow, you're getting old, huh? He said, no, yesterday we walked to the yoga pit and all around in the back to all the places and then came back. He said, therefore, you know, I said, and today we're going to Jagannath Mandir. He said, and when we came back, we gave some bracelets to Radha Madhava. They're wearing them today, right? And I could see, you know, like, that's how one is becoming a success, right? That's how one becomes a success, just by this culture of making a relationship with the deities, of making a relationship with the Dham, of making a relationship with the holy name. And so there are the five principal things, and then there is the support activity, such as, yes, cleanliness, to name one, such as that one should look for a place which is a little pure and sane. One should not go and live in a place which is totally in the mode of ignorance, or it's very difficult, right, to do that. So like that. Maybe for preaching sometimes we have to stay in hellish places. Like in London we have Soho Street, you know, and it's like, it's a fabulous location for preaching. But it's intense, because in the summer when you open the window, then from both sides the noises of the different bars are coming in all night, you know, till 2 o'clock in the morning or something like that, which is like, it's a drag. So, and many places are like that. That may be. But still, we must have this culture. So that is what I've been talking about in terms of tradition. If we look at the culture of the Bhagavatam, I've been saying it a few times, it's a little different than Vedic culture, because the culture of the Bhagavatam is the culture of total surrender to Krishna, and the Vedic culture is mixed with karma kanda, with ritualistic activities for improving one's bodily existence, for getting a better condition of life. But then again, it's also overlapping, because as we are reading about the Pandavas, you know, and Draupadi, etc., they're living within a world that is governed by Vedic culture, and they're following it, and we're seeing that, right? So they know so many things. If we look at the Pandavas, Draupadi, Kunti, etc., there are so many customs. There's a description of a certain ritual in the Bhagavatam where the ladies were walking in front and the men were walking in the back, and all those are customs, you know, that we have no idea about, right? We don't know all those things. So it's certainly interesting to find out more about it and to see how much we can use, because all that will help to make our minds more peaceful, and when we are more peaceful, it will be easier to maintain principles of ashram. Well, there were different points that I was thinking about today. And so today I was wanting to deal with the theme of living in the world. And when we are living in the world, it's a little different than the more renounced ashrams. In the renounced ashrams, we are in one sense, not living in the world very much, right? We are doing things in the world, but we're living in our own little renounced lifestyle. And we don't have to be part of everyday activities. But in the Grihastha ashram, one may have to do that. Not everyone, it depends a little bit on the situation. Depends on how many kids you have, for one thing. And it depends on what you want out of life. Yeah? And it's all right. But as soon as one starts to function in the world, then many things that are part of our culture are no longer possible. Like these clothes, you know? Dhotis, saris, etc. They are special clothes. They are not at all ordinary. And I was once here in Bengal on a train coming from Krishnanagar to Calcutta. And this state, Bengal, has a lot of communists because it's a communist state. So there was one boy on that train. He was wearing shorts, Bermuda shorts, with flowers printed on it, you know? And he came up to me and he goes like, what's that? You know? What's that? Huh? What's that? Huh? I said, what do you mean? He says, those clothes, you know, those clothes. Huh? He says, you know, how can you wear clothes like that? He goes like, so, in India, you know, like, it's weird, huh? So, he goes, How can you wear clothes like that? I said, well, I like them, you know. It's his nice clothes. And he said, you know, strange clothes. So I looked at his pants, you know, the flower runs, etc. So I said, well, you know, do you like those shorts you're wearing? Yeah. So he says, yeah, they're really good, you know, really good. I said, yeah, far out, huh? Nice flower pattern on it. I said, you wear them every day? Are you wearing... He says, no, of course not, you know, of course not. Sometimes, not every day. I said, well, I'm wearing these every day. Yeah, every day. So you want to know why? I said, because these clothes are spiritual, you know, and therefore you can wear them every day. You never get bored from them. And those, you know, you have to have a different one every day. Yeah? Anyway, so I got him a little bit. But that is a fact. These are spiritual clothes, right? Okay, it's not the same dhoti every day, and you know, you can have a little variety, or you know, saris, there's no end to it. That's a whole different story. Whatever may be, and dhotis with borders and all these things, and even sannyas thing, you know, the color and you know, how white the top piece is, you know. See, this one was cut too tight, so it strangles me the whole day. Yeah. So nowadays I know, you know. An extra inch I want on the top, like that, you know. But they're spiritual clothes. There's a protective aspect from just wearing these clothes. There's a shakti, there's a power in them. Even this color, you know, it's supposed to be saffron, not the pink from the tin, but saffron. Saffron is a color in the mode of goodness, right? It automatically invokes the mode of goodness, right? Where blue, you know, is supposed to invoke the mode of ignorance, you know. Yeah? Doesn't matter. It's okay. Sorry about that. Ah, you know, that's all garbage. The only good thing about blue is that Krishna is blue. Right? The sky is blue because Krishna is blue. And therefore it reminds us of Krishna. So in that way, we like it. Okay? And that's why he's wearing a blue kurta, to remind us of Krishna. See? But the point is there, that all these things have their meaning. So when you can't have that, it weakens. Yeah. It makes us weak. And which brings me to a point that spiritual strength is not something we are born with. Right? Nobody is really spiritually strong. It may be that we are in different modes, and that one person is in the mode of ignorance and another person in the mode of goodness, and that it seems easier for someone in the mode of goodness to take up spiritual life. But even it's not at all guaranteed that someone who is very much in the mode of goodness can maintain devotional service. It is said that the bhakti lata creeper does not depend on anything from this world. It depends on bhakti alone and on nothing else. Therefore, only through devotional service can we sustain devotional service, and not actually through other things. So it is not possible simply to to try and be spiritually strong by one's karma. One must, spiritual strength comes from keeping the iron in the fire, that's all. That's where it comes from nothing else, right? And as soon as we think that it doesn't, right? As soon as we think that, well, you know, I have some strength now, right? Or, yeah, it's just me, you know, like it's not so difficult for me. It kind of comes natural for me. Dangerous, dangerous, right? Then we become a big target, right? And Maya will find some opening to enter. So that principle, to keep the iron in the fire, is the only way to survive in spiritual life. And but it is a fact that in the Grihastha ashram, especially when one becomes more involved in being outside in the world, yeah, we have to compromise more. Early mornings were not possible for Prabhupada's father, who had a shop, right? Didn't affect him so much. He had so much piety and so forth. But it might affect us. If it would affect me, right? I definitely feel affected if I don't get up early in the morning. If I don't, therefore I somehow or other just do it, you know. But I've always just done it because I felt such a difference if I didn't do it. Yeah? And but if your work doesn't allow you, that's hell. It's because when you're a grihastha, you cannot take that little nap in the day if you work outside in a job. Yeah? When you have a job, that's what's heavy. Then you have to stay awake all day. So like that, it may be difficult. But then one has to at least compensate for what we lose. Right? That's very important. So we must, in Krishna consciousness, we don't just move in a room and live there, right? And just kind of live. We in Krishna consciousness, we must plan out our conditions of where we reside, what it's going to be like. We must consciously make sure that we are in a very Krishna conscious atmosphere. Okay, I think that is the first point I want to make. If someone wants to comment on that, then please.
I want to comment on clothing.
He was, yeah.
Yeah. So it's kind of like we can do this.
Yeah.
We have to evolve. Is that a story Prabhupada tells about the T-mark?
In the Muslim, yeah. Right? And basically, there was a factory owner who had this factory, and most of the workers were wearing tilak, but then the factory was sold to a Muslim who became the owner, and then he made a new rule. Nobody was allowed to wear tilak, so everyone was afraid, and everyone took it off except for one guy. He did it. And, when the Muslim owner saw his courage, you know, that he stood up for what he believed, he said, okay, you can wear tilak, but nobody else can in this factory. Yeah, that's just the story.
Of course it takes... That's what seems to be the missing...
Yeah, and it may not be possible everywhere, you know. I mean, I don't think that I could go to office like this, you know, in most places. Yeah. But I do know some people, you know, like they work in, someone worked with the road department, you know, and would at least always shaved head, Sika and Tilak. Yeah, just did it. In New York, of course. Maybe in New York it's possible, but it wouldn't happen in some, you know, some conservative small town or something like that, isn't it? So, no, it's practical. One must be practical. But we should realize, though, that if we have to give up wearing these clothes, that we are losing a little bit of the fire, where we keep our iron in the fire, and you could say, you roll the iron a little bit to the side of the fire. It's no longer in the middle of the fire. Put a little on the side of the fire. Still hot, you know, okay. But that's what we do when we stop wearing these clothes. Yeah?
And then yes. Also when the clothes get in the habit and they work outside, and yet also when they come on, they don't
wash
the clothes, or even for the Sunday program,
they Yeah, you grow out of the habit, of course. And then, you know, and then, sure. Yeah, and then you start, you know, sporting something, you know, especially get a little older, you know, like the ladies may decide, well, cut the hair short and get little, you know, curls in there. A man may sport some sideburns or just a little, you know, there it goes, right? All these things, when more hair start growing with the years, you know, these things happen. Yeah, that's how it is. As the years go by, the amount of hair increases. So like that. That can happen. But even if you don't, this thing stops. But Yeah, that's right. there are obviously places, you know, like the fish market, you wouldn't do it. And I could name some other places where I went before where also it wouldn't work. No, I think that there's nothing. Prabhupada definitely left it open, you know, definitely did not speak against wearing such kind of clothing at times, right? But I just wanted to kind of not make it like some sort of narrow moralistic statement, you know, that like a good devotee is a devotee that wears devotional clothing and a bad devotee is one who walked in carny clothes, right? That wasn't the point. But my point was more that it has power. There's no doubt about it. It has a sustaining energy comes from wearing these clothes. Wearing tilak, it's all very sacred, actually, not to be underestimated at all. And so that's something one must consider. And I think that we are not enough conscious of. We take it too lightly. We think, oh well, you know, it's like just a formality, right? I mean, I don't really need that, you know, big deal, etc. But it's not true. And the clothes of modern times. Okay, 1, 2, 3. Go for it. No. It always gets on my nerves. Someone with a camera. Okay, thank you very much. I don't want to focus just on that one thing because that's not the issue. The issue is not clothes. The issue is that we spoke about the clothes as an example of one thing, but there are so many things. Right? I could also, it's also what you have on your wall, you know, that makes a big difference. Right? If you have some good pictures, Prabhupada called them windows to the spiritual world, and they are, you know, and it's not a small thing to look into a window into the spiritual world, actually. It's tremendous power. And we don't, we take it all for granted, right? But I don't know, when I remember my, you know, I had one BTG at one stage, you know, and it was like there was one picture of Krishna, and it's Krishna with a turban who's sitting leaning against a tree with a flute, and in the back, you know, you have some calves and cowherd boys and things like that. It's a very famous picture, everyone. I think many of you will probably recognize the description. And now it's just, oh yeah, nice picture, you know, nice picture. But then it was really something super transcendental for me. You know, when I first had that picture, I was really like looking into the spiritual world. That's how it is, really. So we should take advantage of all these things and be very careful. And that kind of thing is, even if I talk about the Indian sadhu, you know, of course, we do not accept all those men who are sitting on the railway stations, etc., on the platforms with their beards, etc., as 100% pure sadhus. But then again, they are functioning on tradition. Yeah? They're functioning on tradition. And when they may not have the philosophy all the way right, but they definitely have the tradition right. Yeah? Because that is one amazing thing about India, that they still do things today that they've been doing for thousands of years. And that's something that we don't have anymore. I mean, we don't even do, you know, what they did 20 years ago. Things have totally changed, right? So we have no idea. But in India, you have things that are thousands of years old. So every sadhu, you know, like, yeah, they always have that. When they stay somewhere, they carry their little picture, they have their little altar, they do their little puja. It's very much part of their life. So, like you see that here in Bengal, right? If you go to America, every temple has a Bengali pujari, right? That's standard, you know? It's like you have to have your Bengali pujari these days or you're not a temple, right? So why is that, right? Because, yeah, Bengalis make good pujaris. Yeah, why? Because it's so much part of the culture to do puja. Every Bengali does puja. And it's here, like, all the boys, they're into doing puja, into worship. It's part of their culture. They grow up, you know. The mothers, they say to their kids, Jai Koro, Jai Koro, you know, like, make your obeisances, worship. They teach them how to do puja. Right? So it's totally part of the culture. And that we also definitely have to develop. And really doesn't matter what our ashram is. It is so that it is said sannyasis, they can worship the deity in the mind. That is said, because it may not be possible to carry a whole altar on your back, you know, as you're walking around. It's already hard enough. Oh, in modern times also, right? When you travel all the time, it gets limited. But some are traveling with deities, right, all around the world, and it's like quite amazing. And what kind of pujas are going on? Yeah, you know, we just had in the Jumna March in Sydney. I was also in Sydney, and then, phew, it's amazing. What a worship, you know, he's carrying with him, and what a standard. Really, really nice. So, that is possible, and that should be. I stayed with one grihastha in the house, and I'm not saying that he's a model, but he had his style, right? And what it was they had divided the house, and there were a few floors. So there was the top floor was men only. There was another floor for ladies only, and then they had a common floor, just like at the temple, you know. I guess he was still attached to the Brahmachari ashram or something, you know, a place where you can go and be alone. Whatever, they had it like that, and they offered everything to their deity. It was unique. It was, and it was nice. It was nice. It had a nice mood about it because you could see, well, they really make something out of a devotional culture in this house. It's a lot nicer than just walk in some house where, you know, the TV is on and, you know, someone's scratching his belly and say, hurry, bowl, you know. Pull up a chair. Yeah. Want some pizza? And then opens the fridge and drags out this piece of pizza, throws it in the microwave, you know, 5 minutes later, ping, you know. There it is, right? It's a little different. So, it is nice, the culture. Then I had another point today that I was thinking about, and which is something about Gurukul, that Prabhupada set up the education of children with a curriculum based on mainly Bhagavad Gita, reading, writing, simple mathematics, right? And that was it. And nowadays, you know, we feel there's a need for a more society-oriented educational package, right? Because, you know, we don't want our children to become estranged from the world and we want them to be able to integrate and all these things. Whereas Prabhupada really, it didn't have that vision. Right? What can I say? He had a different vision. His vision was... We nowadays may say, well, you know, you said it the other day, you know, you may say, like, well, our children may not be Brahmins, you know, there may be something else. But Prabhupada had a, well, not just for an ashram, it was pretty much Bhagavad Gita for all, right? And very simple kind of educational package.
I was interviewing the headmaster at Gurukul yesterday,
yeah.
Because this was brought to my attention that Prabhupada said, just, you know, based on the curriculum, based on Bhagavad Gita,
yeah.
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 As a matter of fact, you have an exam today on Bhakti Shastra, but it combined the two. But according to Rajit Amaro, she was a student, maybe you can help me back.
She said they went for a stage where they just basically on Krishna, Bhagavatam, reading based on that. They went through that, and they found that many of the group, the only group who's graduated, that they still didn't take it up. They still felt like only for so good of the functional life. And then they went to the other extreme. Right.
Right.
Yeah. She had a quote where she had a letter from Prabhupada where he actually was precisely recommending to learn math, to learn geography, history. The only thing he Prabhupada, because this kind of person is serious, and
yeah.
He led to Sri Prabhupada
yeah.
to give different instructions.
Right.
Only currently a study matter he rejected was biology.
Hmm.
Right, definitely not.
He actually, under yeah. different circumstances, he did recommend
different things.
It was actually in his vision that, like, in that particular.
In that context, right? Yeah. I mean, see, because you can look in the context, but if you look at the broader level of Prabhupada's instructions, the way he started, mostly it wasn't like in the forefront, isn't it? I mean, you know, I'm not advertising one thing or another, actually.
But by experience, he thought that when he could use all the Prabhupada's instructions, not that because some Gurukul that have had this principle of just based on Bhagavad Gita, and they were saying they wasted, they were very angry because they couldn't function in society. They were
right.
saying thank you, but at the same time, they were being angry.
Of course, you could say that that was maybe not due to the educational package. But maybe it was due to not having the right level of teachers. Because we had, instead of, and Prabhupada also at one point said that sannyasis should be teachers. So supposedly very, very mature devotees who could really give some spiritual inspiration.
Modern subject matters, but he applying it, current event.
Yeah.
But he joined it with Krishna consciousness
right.
in such a way that they see with the perspective and the eye of the Shastra. And so there is a way of teaching all those methods, those maybe math is a little more complex to use in the
right.
Bhagavad Gita, but there is a way of teaching and combining with the philosophy.
Okay.
But it takes, like you say, an expert teacher who has that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I didn't want to open up the whole discussion on Gurukul and education. I was actually using it to go to something else. But I just, yeah. But you had some comments, or I thought a few days ago, so I thought, yeah, you might come up with something. And I wanted to also say something, because this thing of the teachers, I often feel that if there would be very nice teachers, that things can be much different. Well, in America, for example, you had Ritadvaja Maharaj. He was teaching a group of boys, and they loved it.
Oh, yeah.
Right? They're very happy with him.
Yeah. Like a friend.
He's like a friend, you know. But then for a while, you know, in Vrindavan, there was 1 year. Jagadish, when he was still a sannyasi, moved 1 year into the Brahmachari ashram with the Brahmacharis. And that ashram, those were the boys who were like 13. And that was a very good year. I mean, it was really good. Those boys were... Well, it was nice. I mean, it was like very mature association. Of course, it didn't work out nice. Whatever. That's another in the end. But that was a good year, it seemed. Now, my point though is, I wrote next. A major question is: should we practice Krishna consciousness now, in the same way it was practiced when Srila Prabhupada was present, or should we consider that the times have altered and that the spirit must remain unchanged, but the form may be adjusted? Right? And that's like a theme that comes up a lot today in some places in the world, even in a very strong way. In Germany it came up very strong after Hari Kesh left. It became like a big discussion topic, right? We have to, And statements were made. It said, like, the problem with Prabhupada disciples, they said, right, is that they are so rigid, right, that they just can't see that the times have changed and that we have to do things different now than they were done then, you know. And they just want to keep it all exactly the same as when it was, when Prabhupada was around. And if a slight little change, they're afraid. And actually, the times have changed a lot. We have to have a whole different... way of life. So I thought that could maybe bring out a little discussion. I was hoping that point, some comments. Or, yeah.
Some things seem obvious, like we're not living with a bunch of hippies anymore. We don't call it the love hippies, we call it the Sunday hippies.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the principles are always the same. We should try our best.
Okay, you went back to 67, but not to 77. At 77, it was already Sunday feast. ISKCON 77 was an established movement, right? It looked a lot like ISKCON today. I didn't join 67, I have no idea what it's like, but 77 was, that was...
Sometimes you still use the feast.
You still go like the love feast thing. Baby, baby. It's coming back, yeah? Yeah. Okay, but it's a point. Sure. Some things seem obvious. Have changed. Okay, and the point was already made earlier by your mother also, that things are... in Prabhupada's times also, it didn't all stay the same. There were changes. Right? But is it really very different now? Should we have a whole different... Should ISKCON look really different than it looked in especially those latter years, from late 70s?
One problem is that everyone has a different understanding of what Prabhupada actually wanted. You know, at some points, some of the early students feel that Prabhupada would have been changing, like you said, Prabhupada didn't make changes as well.
Yeah.
So what I'm going to say is that the main problem is that there are differences of opinions amongst the leaders.
I'll paraphrase what he said.
That causes some kind of moral struggle in respect to the different parties.
Okay, so the first point he made is that Prabhupada did, if he would have been here today, he might have well made such adjustments himself. Since he was always making adjustments, he would have also made adjustments now. That was the first point. And the second, and the other point was that there are a lot of different perspectives on what Prabhupada really wanted, etc. Different people have their own angles on Prabhupada's points. And so we have so many warring fractions and things like this. You had a hand, yeah. But that was much earlier than 77, actually, that Prabhupada started saying that. I think he said that in 72. Huh? Very early. It's in 72 he said that. Yeah. I can't hear you very well. The echo. Okay, so another thing I can think of is that when Prabhupada was present, the variety of age was, the whole division of age in our movement was totally different. Everybody was young, right? In between 20 and 30 was the average age. And 20 and 30 is obviously the stage in one's life where many people are not married. And even if they are, it doesn't make such a big difference, right? Even if you're married, when you're, you know, that young, you sleep anywhere in a cupboard and it's all right, you know, you call it home, sweet home, and you're happy. But once people get 40 or 50, now we have all kinds of generations, and we have many devotees, right? Approaching 50. I think now the average age, yeah, it's about 40 to 60. There is a whole bunch of devotees in between that age now. All those who were there from Prabhupada's days, many who came right after, all between 40 and 60. Plus there's a whole other new generation, people that have joined, people that were born in the movement and the whole thing. So we have a broader need now, a more varied need, right? Obviously. So in that way, there are obviously different things that will play than played before. Someone else, something on this topic? You have to speak very loud with the
mic. Is there something precise you're talking about?
Are you Canadian or German? Okay. I'm going to tell you. Yeah? That it's, you could try, you know, and pinpoint Krishna consciousness exactly like to something super precise. But I think that then you'll find that something else will also be true. Yeah? Because Krishna is himself manifesting different moods, different situations, different times. So in this regard, I'm not talking about something precise, I'm talking about a principle, and I'm talking about how far do we want to go with this, right? How far do we think that we are ready to experiment with new things, and how far do we think we should conservatively sit on a body of Srila Prabhupada's instructions and Srila Prabhupada's examples and say, this is it, right? And we're sitting here, and then we are the defenders of it, and anybody who steps outside of this is questionable, and anything that is done that wasn't done within this kind of framework of Prabhupada's examples and instructions and his books and so forth is like doubtful. And so we have these two kind of moods in our movement. We have like one is a more fundamentalist, the other one is a more liberal mood. It started from day one. I call it East Coast, West Coast mood, right? The East Coast strictness of New York and the Brahmacharis, and the West Coast liberals, you know, of San Francisco. So, what is the... What? You are, maybe, but I don't think I am. But is life so black and white? Because he said it before. What you think you're following Prabhupada, I'm doing the opposite, and I'm thinking I'm following Prabhupada as well. I think that what I do is right, and I think what you're doing is totally wrong, but you're convinced that it's right because you think I'm a Prabhupada Anuga. I'm following Prabhupada. No? Is there any clear? Maybe not, because... Well, maybe not, because some things are very clear. 16 rounds, 4 regulative principles, you know, like that's very clear. But then there are other areas which are maybe gray areas, right, which are not so clear, because you will have many, many senior devotees who will have their own perspectives on it. And sometimes one may be on one side of the scale, and the other one totally on the other side. So it's not always that everything within the philosophy of Krishna consciousness is black and white. There's clearly a core, you know, a core of knowledge that is, okay, that's without a doubt, you know, 16 rounds, 4 eggs, etc. That's clear. Mangalarti, it's clear, you know, like. But some things are not just clear. And if you try to make it all so clear, then you... then some people will find that you are a fanatic brahmachari, right, who has a very narrow-minded idea of Krishna consciousness, a little box, and who's just feeling anything outside this box is Maya. And then you get like a rift between the temple devotees and devotees who are not so strict. And we've had that in our movement, and you know, there's a whole history of that, and it's still a little going on, some estrangement between temple devotees and devotees outside the temple. I hear so much rattling there from the...
Yeah, I can really relate to what you said, because...
Anumanta.
Yeah, because when I first came to the movement, it was 1972 in Geneva, and I remember that I was just a teenager in high school, but I remember that the mood was, if you want to be a devotee, you got to leave everything and move into the temple. And once you're in the temple, even to get initiated in those days, because when Prabhupada came to Geneva, because I was not living full-time at the temple, he had said that there was 2 teenagers in the States that had been initiated, and once they got their names, they didn't come back. So I have to wait extra longer because I was not really in the temple. Now, it's not the example that is always like that. There are just devotees that got initiated living outside. But most of the time, the mood was, being a devotee means you live in the temple, and once you live in the temple, the mood was also, do the needful. You know, doesn't matter what your propensity, your nature, what you have to distribute books.
Yeah.
And it worked out okay, because for me, sales and distributing books was something that I have no problem with. But I know some devotees had difficulty because their nature were not so outgoing, therefore they found it difficult.
Yeah.
As time went by, I noticed that, but also in those years, though he established New Vrindavan, which was plain living, high thinking, living in the country, and developing Krishna consciousness, not always being on the street distributing. So there was, even in those days, there were two, like you were said, the East Coast and West Coast. There was different mood, different preaching that Prabhupada gave according to time and place. But when I came here for the Maipur Festival in 76 and 77, I remember the stress Prabhupada was giving toward the Varnashram Dharma, toward establishing a system by which one is engaged according to do the needful was also there, and surrender, and you know, but there was more of an alternative. You can be Krishna conscious at home, and you can practice it as a guest. There were the parallel with preaching, that there was more stress
Yes.
So I see that all through the years that the mood would have changed.
Yeah.
But within, I would totally agree that within Prabhupada's presence, Prabhupada
yes.
would preach differently at different places and according to the need of the temple and the participants, whoever he met, guests.
Yeah.
Certain guests, he would be like straightforward. That I remember this one guest came in Geneva, and he came and then Prabhupada spoke to him for maybe 30 seconds, and he said, "You are a devotee," and he brought the harmonium and they had the bhajan. You know, he was first time in the temple, but Prabhupada immediately saw him that he was a devotee and he had the bhajan. Whereas his other guests, I was wow, he would be very very heavy, you know. And, beyond what we could perceive.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd say it's not black and white.
Really. Yeah. You see, so this is a little bit of response also to what you're saying. You can't so exactly say, but what did Prabhupada say? You know, didn't he say something really clear? No. in some cases, not so black and white. There is room to fill it in. It's a controversial point. We also find that in that biography done by Sukhavak. Huh? And then he quotes that point also, and he puts it a little more in context. And this Krishna Samhita was a book. It was originally brought out in a lecture at this point. And at that time, Bhaktivinoda Thakur was not really acting as an acharya of Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition. So, In Sukhavak's book, it is also then described how he made that statement about the Bhagavatam, right? That there are, in other words, purely spiritual and absolute aspects to the Bhagavatam, and that there are relative aspects to the Bhagavatam. And therefore, that the question, how old, how long ago is something, you know, was not at all, is not so important, because things like that need not be seen in the absolute sense, could also be part of the relative aspect of the Bhagavatam. And that is a little controversial, because Prabhupada really took the Bhagavatam so literal. I mean, that much, right? I would not dare to entertain, you know. Like, when I read that point, I also read it in the Krishna Samhita, and when I read it in that biography done by Sukhavak, that somewhere started at 100, page 125, I remember. You know, I was reading the whole book, and then at 100, page 125, it started like, And then it went on and on, and, you know, then the end of the book became a little, it wasn't like totally clear and straight. It was a little controversial. So, with that point, I feel we have to be careful. If we start to see some of Prabhupada's instructions are absolute and some are in the relative sphere, gets a little. Huh? I'm getting scared with that. So then I become quite. In that regards, I'm quite fundamentalist. Then I say, well, you know, like I'd rather stay with what he said and like, you know. And
I just meant that it's sort of what culture would do.
Right. Yeah.
That's,
Yes, well, the words are heavy. Maybe you didn't mean so much so heavy, but that's an interesting point. Yeah. So anyway, say it again. That's for that the. I think, in a positive sense, one could say that there are certain things which are fixed, absolutely fixed, and cannot be changed. Principles, but other things can be adjusted, right? And Prabhupada adjusted the form of things sometimes quite strongly, and we can also do. Yeah. Loud and clear. Yeah, that's okay. So, but that's a simple. It sounds a little simplistic to me, with all due respect, you know. Yeah, but when I've heard that argument, you know, like many times, but sometimes it really concerns major things, like as she was explaining, you know, you were living in the temple, right? And it's just like that also in my time, you know. And anybody who was a devotee who didn't live in the temple, he had blooped, right? Didn't matter, you know. A whole family, anybody, if a grihasthas were just not living in the temple and not coming to the temple, we considered them blooped, right? They may have been following, right? Something or whatever, you know. They were blooped, right? They were totally, that was it. Well, that's, hold on. No. But hold on. That's not just a... You see, you're judging that time from your modern... what you've learned about Krishna consciousness now. But if... Now, let me just finish my point. But Prabhupada himself was kind of speaking like that about devotees living outside. You know, sometimes quite strong. Right? And many statements you can find where Prabhupada spoke strongly. By who? Yeah, that's true. So you can make a case where Prabhupada sanctioned these things, but you can also see several incidents where Prabhupada spoke that devotees who live outside practically have no chance to survive in their Krishna consciousness, right? So you can also make a case on the other side of the issue. You know, it's like I didn't do the exercise for you to dig out the quotes, but they're known quotes. I'm sure that some of you are aware of these quotes. So Prabhupada was certainly not just as much encouraging. In that time, at least, he was not encouraging people to live outside as much as we would encourage it now. Nowadays, it's become... See, what happened is this, if I may paint the history of ISKCON a little bit, is that over the years, more and more devotees felt that, especially after Prabhupada left, when Prabhupada was there, everyone was very inspired because Prabhupada was ultimately bringing out love out of everyone's heart. So out of love for Prabhupada, devotees, they made such a sacrifice, did so many things. Then the next generation of leaders, they were much heavier. Yeah? They were already there when Prabhupada was there, but they were much heavier. And they were demanding the same surrender, but they did not have the same loving dealings as Prabhupada had. So they didn't bring out as much love in the heart of the devotees. So then but they demanded the same surrender. So then it was done out of duty and remembering Prabhupada and doing it for Prabhupada, but the leader himself did not endear himself to devotees. So it became more and more heavy. And therefore, with time, you know, more and more people said, look, you know, I don't have to do this, right? Forget it, you know? I don't have to do this, right? You know, you can do it on your own, you know? If you want to do it this way, go do it. I'll go live my own life. And more people moved out. right? And then the temple devotees are kind of like hearing, well, this person is envious, this person is off, this person is that. But then in due course of time, there were more devotees on the outside than on the inside. Right? That's what happened. Then, so at one stage, the devotees still in the temple doing the straight old-fashioned program, right, became the minority. And then we try to bring it back together again, and suddenly, you know, like we welcome everybody back now, and we are apologizing for all the things we have, all the mistreatment from all these years, and demonizing people, and now that has become the new fashion, right? Now our mood is like, oh yes, you know, it's everything is all right, and it's like, you know, we have to be more broad and more open, and this is what's going now, kind of.
You know, like you said, the love feast is coming back there, isn't it?
Yeah, something like that. Now, so it's again, I'm sure what Ravindra Sarup was pointing out in the context of what he's presenting makes a lot of sense. And I'm not trying to say that Prabhupada was not in favor of people in their private situation being Krishna conscious, but the emphasis was definitely in another direction. That's the point. But I was just looking.
I see it as, you know, the circumstances are changing constantly, so you want to adjust in the way you do it. So the principle is still there.
Yeah. Yeah, of course.
At least that's what the leaders picked up. You know, it's not necessarily what Prabhupada would instruct everywhere he went, because there were, it's that's where he would encourage someone to stay home. But the leaders, for managerial purposes, for having manpower,
yeah,
they really emphasized when Prabhupada saying to sleep in the temple.
Right.
That was not necessarily all of Prabhupada's teaching. That was what they picked up as the most useful for their managerial.
It's true that at the end of Prabhupada's presence on the planet, then there were all these strong, heavy leaders always surrounding him, and they were kind of guarding him, and one could not approach Prabhupada.
Yeah.
Right? And they were just, you know, no one had any access. They were just like a wall. Right? And the common devotees, they heard what Prabhupada wanted through the leaders. Sometimes also, of course, something direct, etc. But many things through the leaders. And later also, many devotees felt that they were blocked, actually, from having that the natural relationship with Prabhupada. Like, one thing was that Prabhupada, at the end, when he was about to leave this world, wanted all the devotees to come, and the leaders kept everyone away. Right? And many devotees are, like, you know, still walking around, like, you know.
Yeah. Prabhupada wanted all the disciples to come.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the order was that only one per temple.
Right. Not at all. But the whole message out to the society was much different. And many devotees feel like, you know, we were called and we were not allowed to be there. And it's like, you know, some people have strong feelings about that still. Anyway, that's all not a matter of blaming anyone. It was very difficult to be leaders, right? And to be a leader, you see, to be a real leader means that you work on the strength of inspiration. But when you don't have the power to inspire, then you will derive some of your leadership from your position. You know, I'm the temple president. You know, you ought to respect me because that's the position. I'm the GBC. You have to respect because I have this position. So then one derives authority from the position. And so because they were young, they naturally start to hide behind a position. You know? Like if you have to tell somebody something that's a little heavy, you put a big desk between you and the person. It's very intimidating. You know, put a big desk, you sit behind. Looks really like, yes, come in. Sit behind the other side. Yes. It's a lot of authority from the desk, you know. But if you have more maturity, then you can, of course, inspire more from the, from the heart, then you don't need all these externals. So, because these leaders were very young, actually very young devotees and very quickly becoming big leaders, they fell in that trap of using the authority, you know, of their position rather than the inspiration. So we should not think that they were a bunch of demons and you know, power-hungry exploiters, etc. Not necessarily so. They were trying to do a difficult job. And Prabhupada was quite demanding. I mean, he was demanding things from them, right? He wanted results, and therefore, when they wanted to keep the devotees in the temple, that wasn't just manipulation. They really had to produce something. So, and I guess, yeah, it's 1 o'clock, but we can finish.
Didn't Srila Prabhupada say that everything is in his books? Then,
yes.
Then, isn't there all the instructions for white and black?
Okay, but then I read something else than what you read, and then I understand it different than you, and he understands it different than the two of us, and then he again has a different idea, and she has a different idea, and so, and then we divide up in groups. But you know, like everything is an interpretation. You cannot just some things are very clear. 16 rounds, you know, these basic principles are very, very clear, right? That there will be no discussion about, right? But then, like, how did Srila Prabhupada really want the disciplic succession to continue? And how did he want the guru process to be conducted in our society? Well, now you've got a can of worms, you know, right, which is pretty big. And if you open that one up, then you get so many realizations and ideas and opinions that it's like just inconceivable. Now, there are some principles there also that are, well, that will be, some people will attack those also, but there is a large forum of devotees that agree about some basic principles. But there are many, many details where there are also different understandings and different interpretations. So the reality is you'll have to live with fixed principles, but also with some varying understandings in Krishna consciousness. And you cannot in all cases say, but, you know, everything is in Prabhupada's books, then it must be totally clear. It's not always totally clear. Yeah, I thank you also. So, just to say the last thing, and then we go, is that the bottom line of today's conclusion, which was brought out several times, is totally correct, that certain principles must be maintained, and we should not sacrifice principles. And we can adjust the form, but personally I would recommend that even when we do adjust the form, that we are careful with that. That we are not just doing it with great leisure and ease, you know, and just think, times have changed. And I think we should think about it, because obviously whatever Prabhupada did, especially and introduced, was blessed. And we must be careful. And as I pointed out, there are many letters where Prabhupada said that if you live away from the temple, right, that then you will not be able to maintain spiritual standards. There are many, many letters like that also. And it is a consideration, because I think that's what we see. You know, I mean, I think I see that. I think a lot of people who are just too far away from the temple and are not doing so well spiritually. So therefore, without hammering on it has to be in this form or that form, I would say maintain the principles, adjust forms where need be, but be a little careful, a little conservative. That's my conclusion. Okay, Rupa.
Can I just ask a question about Dhamma? You're pointing out how can Dhamma can
we can, how about doing it tomorrow? Because I had something on the Holy Name tomorrow. You're going to be here tomorrow, maybe?
Yeah.
Because somebody invited me for lunch. Yeah. Thank you very much.